conversation. It's a real pleasure to be here. So what I'm going to be talking about today is actually joint work with Sean, and it's kind of the next stage in a project we've been working on for some time. And so really what I want to do today is present a framework which has got a kind of what we think is a number of quite attractive features. So firstly, what we can do in our framework is identify and construct observables and their evolution in totally constrained systems in a different way to conventional frameworks for treating these systems. So essentially, it's a generalized Hamilton-Jacobi formalism, and it contains the Dirac observables of a conventional approach to these systems as a special case. And so one of the kind of more conceptual insights that we can get from putting things in our language and our formalism is we can think about the complete observables framework slightly differently and actually give limited support to an interpretation of the partial observables as a measurable, which Ravelli has actually notably defended and has been criticized in various places. In the end, the kind of result of our formalism for the systems we can apply it to is a Schrödinger-type formalism rather than a Wheeler-DeWitt-type formalism. Although we start with a reparameterization invariant theory, i.e., so a theory of a Hamiltonian constraint, we end up with a theory which has dynamical wave functions and superpositions of energy eigenstates, and the algebra of observables is larger than if it was quantized using a conventional approach. Interestingly, as we only found quite recently, there's a nice connection to a mini superspace model that Wald and Unruh presented back in 1989. And really what our framework does is give an alternative way to get to the same model. And then lastly, and probably slightly more speculatively, what our framework can give is a new prescription for canonical quantization of gravity that really singles out the starting point as the shape dynamics formalism. Okay, so I want to give a bit of motivation to the ideas I'm going to talk about, and it's really about how we should think about symmetries, like one of the most basic questions in physics you can ask. So on our view, you should distinguish between two notions of gauge invariance. The first notion arises when there's an equivalence class of states in the state space of a theory identified as physically indistinguishable. And this notion of physically indistinguishable states is really central to our work. And as is well known, when you have these types of symmetries, you have an underdetermination problem in the evolution equations of the system. Even when obviously you're dealing with a classical formalism which is deterministic. There's also a second notion of symmetry, which is closely connected but distinct to from this first notion, which is where you have gauge invariance arising from an equivalence class of histories in the state space. And a symmetry at the level of histories is defined directly in terms of invariance of the action. And so with these notions, these two different notions of symmetry, symmetries at the level of states and symmetries at the level of histories, we can make a further distinction. And this is because a state symmetry obviously implies the existence of history symmetry as a special case, since the history is just a sequence of states. But the converse doesn't have to be true. You can have history symmetries without state symmetries. And this leads to the following further distinction. We think of type 1 symmetries as existing when there's a history symmetry and a corresponding state symmetry. And this is by far and away the most typical type of symmetry that you encounter in gauge theories. But there's also a second type of symmetry, which we're calling type 2, for want of a better name. And it exists where there is a history symmetry, but there isn't a corresponding state symmetry. As we just illustrate this simple but for us very fundamental distinction in this rather complex plot. So you see, type 1 means there is a history symmetry and there isn't a state symmetry. Sorry, type 2 means there is a history symmetry and there isn't a state symmetry. That's the thing to really hold in mind. And so the most significant insight gained from this distinction relates to the quantization of reparameterization invariant theories. The Dirac quantization algorithm implements a kinematical prescription to remove the dependence of both the wave function and the observables on the parameters that label the gauge orbits connecting physically indistinguishable states. That's at least how Dirac defines it in his original 1964 lectures. That notion of indistinguishability at that level is really fundamental to the prescription for canonical quantization, at least in Dirac's framework. And this is explicitly motivated by the identification of states along gauge orbits as equivalent. So although such an identification... Yep.
Sorry, before you go further, can you tell us what the difference is between a history and a state? In my mind,
okay, so I'm defining states as points in a state of a space of instantaneous data.
So when the dynamical problem is well posed, there's a one-to-one correspondence between history and initial data.
Sure, but that doesn't mean isomorphism doesn't entail equivalence. So the idea is that although we can use initial data to label histories, we shouldn't treat the initial data as equivalent to histories. And that's like I imagine this will be a point of debate about precisely how we flesh out these distinctions.
Are you going to give us an example of a type here?
Yes. Okay, so I think at the level of, if we define a state in terms I was talking about, and if we're dealing with a type one theory, nothing we're going to say to a large extent is going to differ with 50-year-old or many decades-old kind of approaches to physics. It's really the type two symmetries that where we want to make slight differences. So really what we want to say is that the identification which is used as a basis for canonical quantization really relies upon the notion of type 1 symmetry and isn't justified for type 2 symmetry. So in our view, the Dirac quantization algorithm is only justified for the type 1 case. And we actually, if you kind of agree with us up to here, I think you can also agree that one requires a new definition of observables and a new approach to the quantization of gauge theories of type 2 symmetries. And that's what we're aiming to provide in terms of what we call relational quantization. So the kind of plan is really to talk about this generalized Hamilton-Jacobi formalism in a little bit of detail and apply it to a simple particle model, then talk about quantization and the exact what differences we're proposing in this relational quantization approach, and then finally get to the all-important case, which is really motivating a lot of this, of why this is an interesting question, which is gravity.
Is the West Sands version of the idea that a reparameter, in the particle model of reparameterization diet changes the parameterization of the history without changing the definition of the state's law?
Yeah. So a lot of this, like the notion of a type 2 symmetry really is essentially the notion of a global reparameterization symmetry. We're trying to keep the way we set up the definitions fairly general from the outset. But that's the only application of the type 2 notion that we have at the moment. Okay, so let me talk about this generalized framework first, and then so hopefully give some intuition for what we're claiming. So if we take a very general canonical action of a totally constrained Hamiltonian theory on some phase space, taking this form here, we just leave undetermined what the constraints are. And what we're aiming to do is find a canonical transformation that parameterizes the flow of the set of constraints, which we assume to be abelianized, on the phase space, and restricts this flow to the constraint surface defined by the constraints. And to do this, we introduce a modified action, where one of the great privileges of coming to Perimeter is being able to use a hockey stick during a talk, so where we've introduced these additional variables here. And that's the extension of the action. So the new memento, which we've introduced, which we're labeling epsilon, a constant of motion by definition. And for the initial condition of them vanishing, this extended theory just goes back to the original theory. And what we're aiming to do is find a canonical transformation that parameterizes the flow of the constraints. And we can achieve this by requiring that the new coordinates, so we're taking a symplectomorphism to a new set of canonical coordinates, which we're labeling by the capital letters, has zero flow under the transform constraints, so that they are analogous to the initial data of the standard Hamilton-Jacobi formalism. So really what we're doing is applying the more than 100 years old notion of how you derive the Hamilton-Jacobi formalism to a slightly more general case. So for the old coordinates, we additionally require that the momenta are constrained to be equal to the constraint functions themselves. And so with these requirements, we can calculate a type 1 generating functional for the transformation, taking the lowercase coordinates to the uppercase coordinates. And that's quite straightforwardly takes this form here. But what we're really interested in, or what gives us the formalism which allows us to, that we want to use as a starting point, is a type 2 generating functional, which after some work, we can show that the canonical transformation which satisfies our requirements will fulfill this equation 4, which is one of the crucial equations, probably one of the 3 or 4 crucial equations of the talk. Now, you can take an Anstaz for this generating functional, and you can identify the separation constants actually as the enlarged canonical momenta coordinates. And then we obtain the kind of second really important equation, that the generating functional will take this form, which means that, as advertised, we're getting a canonical transformation parameterized by the coordinates we've introduced, which, remember, are the coordinates along the orbits generated by the constraints. So W is determined by the particular equation, by the particular model you're trying to deal with.
Your Ricci equation.
Oh, so to satisfy W, you'd have to you'd basically get a reduced equation by putting 6 into 4. And then you'd have to solve that for W.
Don't you have it?
I think so. No, I don't. But we'll actually apply this to a model, and you'll see how it works in that case.
Can you remember
where it is phi, uppercase, and lowercase? So phi lowercase, so if I actually go to this diagram, phi lowercase is the parameter of the gauge orbit. Phi uppercase is we're extending the phase space, and then we're doing a canonical transformation. So phi lowercase is the parameter of the gauge orbits in the original canonical coordinates, and phi uppercase is the parameter of is the transformed phi.
Is it the phi,
no, it's a position variable. Its momenta is going to be the
conserved quantity. So where is phi uppercase?
It's the canonical transform. So basically, q. And little phi go to big Q and big phi. P and little e go to big P and big E in the canonical transformation. So if you go, where is it? We had it. So these are the new canonical coordinates here that we're transforming to.
So what is the
phi lowercase and e lowercase are the original coordinates.
So can you show what they were originally?
So if you take the action. Yeah. Sean, do you want to say so?
When you say you make a chemical transformation, so what are you looking for? I mean, you start to extend that phase space, and then.
So we're looking for a canonical transformation that will allow the extended variables to parameterize the gauge orbits. So we want to be able to to treat, so treat the new face, like physical face space coordinates, the big Q and big P, as initial data, and then be able to use phi to label the transformation along the orbit to different values of the initial data, calculated at different points on the gauge orbits or the orbits associated with the constraints. Yeah, it's related.
In the normal Hamilton Jacobi framework, it would be the phi would be like the time, right? So the big Qs and Ps would just be some initial data on phase space. The little Qs and little Ps would be some the value of those Qs after some time under the flow of the Hamiltonian. The only difference here is that the flow is not the Hamiltonian, it's just this arbitrary constraint C. No, I think at the moment it's just a framework for saying, like, if I want to move a certain distance along the orbit, and I don't know how to explicitly parameterize that orbit in terms of the original.
Yes, iteration. You add something, but.
Yeah.
Also, usually you can actually choose a which one of them, which is part of the space space one of the other.
So that's actually quite a central point to the talk, right? I think that you can do that is one way of packaging what we want to say, in fact. But I think if you start, the idea is to start in the most general formalism as possible, and then really what the distinction between types of symmetries does is allow you to understand different situations in which you're using the physical variables to parameterize the orbit and what the interpretation of that is. So we will get to this as an idea in the talk as we go on. Any other questions?
So the bottom line, I'm sure I understand, that phi uppercase is a gauge parameter.
But both phi uppercase and phi lowercase are gauge parameters. They just.
By your case, I think it was the. Because that's why the case and phi lowercase were conjugate to each other.
Yeah, no, they're transformed versions of each other. So phi and e are conjugate to each other.
Phi is initial.
Yeah. Okay, so the kind of long and short of where we get to is that you can then define the Hamilton-Jacobi equation of motion in terms of this generating functional, which we have in the kind of taking this form 6 here. And then we actually read this as an equation for Q in terms of the initial data, the constants of motion, and the parameters phi. And the interpretation of this equation, the point is that once we're at this situation, we have different options of how to treat this equation depending upon the way we want to understand the constraints and the symmetries associated with them. So for the type 1 symmetries, the idea is, as per the kind of standard approaches, the phis are going to parameterize on physical flow. So we can compute observables by first imposing the vanishing of the conserved quantities and then eliminating the phi alpha dependence. And we can either do this by gauge fixing or by constructing families of complete observables, which would be precisely using the phase-based parameters, the Qs and Ps, to eliminate the phi dependence. And we think, like, although the complete observable program does give us a lot of insight into the structure, in this case, for the type 1 symmetries, it's more natural simply just to gauge fix, at least when we can. However, for the type 2 symmetries, because there's no redundancy at the level of instantaneous physical states, as we've defined it, the phi alphas parameterize physical change. And to compute observables, we can impose the equivalence of the conserved quantities to the constraints. And although our position is that there's no necessity to eliminate the phi alpha dependence because it's parameterizing physical change. We shouldn't treat it as something we can measure, but it's still something physically significant. However, there's always an option to construct families of complete observables by eliminating this using one of the equations for one of the physical variables as a clock. The point is that we have the option, we really have two options. We can stick with the integrals of motion defined in terms of the parameters, or we can eliminate the parameters and define the complete observables. But we can't gauge fix in this situation.
Can you explain, now that you have a model, can you explain what you mean by tight-point symmetry for two symmetry? Because three was to have
tight-point. Sure, well, I'm actually going to do an explicit model in the next slide. Maybe that'll help.
Because here, I'm not sure what you mean by
sure. So, type one. So this is exactly the, hopefully this will help. So we just use a simple finite dimensional model with the total Hamiltonian in this form. So we have two constraints, a Hamiltonian constraint, so it's a reparameterization invariant particle model, and we also have a kind of Gauss constraint. So we have something that's like acting a lot like the momentum constraints of ADM GR. And the idea is that, so this constraint shifts the center of mass. So in this situation, this is the kind of cleanest example. We want to say that the reparameterizations are type 2 because we're associating them only with a symmetry at the level of histories in the phase space and not with a symmetry at the level of states. But the Gauss-like constraint, this constraint that's just shifting the center of mass of the system, is type 1. It's just a spatial translation. It's actually, if you want an older notion of it, it's actually a Leibniz shift. This is really what Leibniz in 1715 was talking about when he's saying in Newtonian mechanics you can shift the whole universe and nothing should change. And so this is a symmetry acting at the level of states and at histories, whereas the Hamiltonian constraint is just giving a global reparameterization of the path without actually changing the sequence of states which the path goes through. Does that make more sense now?
I'm not sure I get it.
Well, let me put it this way.
The make a difference between states and history, but in the phase space formulation, there is no difference. So I'm kind of confused.
Well, put it this way, right?
You can treat them differently.
Reparameterizations act on just a different space. They don't act on phase space points, right? Reparameterization is something that acts on a history. A state can reparameterize a history. Reparameterize a point in phase space. And that's the main observation that we're making.
Well,
these things are really distinct.
Well, put it the other way. If I
let's say here, okay, well, you have two constraints, H and P, and from the point of view of phase space, they're just three constraints. Now you want to treat them differently.
Sure.
So.
But there's a good physical motivation for treating them differently, because if I get a point in phase space and I hit it with the Hamiltonian constraint, I get I get evolution. If I get a point in phase space and I hit it with this P, I just get a shifted version of the same physics. I just change my center of mass. I'm doing something that doesn't have a physically significant interpretation.
Yes, yeah, but it could be part of your Hamiltonian. You could have an Hamiltonian.
So we're assuming that we're in a constrained Hamiltonian theory, which is...
So here you're assuming that among all the Lagrangian multipliers, there is one which is special, which is n, which corresponds to time, and the other one, which are not.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, sure.
So how is this different from
I think it's quite different. So I think both of them could be given active and passive interpretations in different spaces. So you could actually think about in the space of so you could have a passive or an active interpretation of the second constraint. I'm not sure what an active interpretation of a reparameterization would mean. But I don't think that distinction's different to this distinction, I would say, although perhaps related. Okay, so the idea is that given this setup and given our definitions, we can then kind of turn the handle. So we extend the action just as I was advocating in general terms. And our extended variables tau and sigma are just the arbitrary labels for time and the center of mass, respectively. And then we think of the conjugate variables in different ways. The energy is the conjugate to the time, and we think of that as a redefinition of the total energy of the system. And the other conjugate momenta is the total linear momentum of the system. And kind of foreshadowing, the crucial point is that because we're dealing in a system which is invariant under translations, the total momentum is constrained to be zero. But because we're not treating the transformations associated with the Hamiltonian constraint as unphysical, the total energy isn't constrained to be zero, which is, in the end, what gives us different physics in the quantum field. In that sense, yes, it's... No. Well, it is in terms of it defines a surface, but that surface can have non-zero value.
But that's really a question. The crucial point is that what you can do, there's this coupling constant which is sitting around in the Hamiltonian constraint, which is the energy. And all you're basically doing is just promoting it to constant of motion, so that like constant of nature. So the theory is still equivalent.
So essentially what we're saying is that the parameterized particle dynamics formalism and the where you have this PT term is really physically identical to the kind of pure Jacobi formalism where you don't have this extra term. And so just kind of inserting all the equivalent formulas into our form for our generating functional. So the W from before for this system is just simply given by like little q and big P, which is just an ANSTAS. But it gives us exactly what we expect. So the equation of motion for the system just gives us the usual integral of motion for the free particle, plus an extra term which shifts the origin of each particle by sigma. And so what we think is that this model actually makes really, really crystal clear the distinction between type 1 and type 2 symmetries. So the sigma parameterize unphysical changes, and the relevant conserved quantities, which are the total linear momentum, are constrained to be zero. On the other hand, tau parameterizes dynamical physical change, even though tau itself isn't physical. And the relevant conserved quantity, which is energy, is allowed to be non-zero. So if you take our interpretation of the symmetries and you apply it to the simple model, it gives you what we think is quite a reasonable way of understanding a theory which has the translational symmetry and reparameterization symmetry, which is that there's still... Oh, God. There's still change, as I think that illustrated. And so what we want to do is that, as I said before, for type 1 symmetries, it's very natural just to take a gauge fixing. And for a symmetry associated with spatial translation, it's very natural to take a gauge fixing according to the center of mass of the system. So if we do that, we can then reduce our integrals of motion to basically to center of mass coordinates. And once we've done that, we kind of remove the center of mass and we have Dirac observables with respect to the P0 constraint. So we basically, by gauge fixing a coordinate for sigma, we fix it so that the reduced coordinates will have no flow along the orbits associated with spatial translations. So we're basically just picking a center of mass frame. On the other hand, if we apply a gauge fixing to the type 2 symmetries, as I'm sure you'd expect, by picking a time, we just constrain our integrals of motion to be equal to our initial data. So we can't get evolution out of the system that way. So what we'd like to do is identify the physically relevant observables of the system as those corresponding to the entire set of configuration variables, so the center of mass coordinates, after removing the center of mass. And this is precisely what Kukash advocated for how to think about observables in general relativity. If we kind of just substitute the translation constraints for the momentum constraints of GR and the Hamiltonian constraints for the Hamiltonian constraints of GR. There's obviously subtleties regarding foliation invariance, which mean that what he was suggesting is slightly different to what we're suggesting here. And that's something I'll talk about quite a bit towards the end of the talk.
It sounds to me like what you're calling type 1 and type 2 is really the difference between global and gauge symmetries.
Oh, no. I wouldn't say that.
Because global symmetries change your point in phase space. Gauge symmetries don't. Only act on the history. Gauge symmetries constrain the total charge to be zero.
So I think they're related, but the point is that as we're defining it, there is one very important point. If you think about gauge symmetries in terms of non-invertibility of the Hessian Legendre transformation, or in terms of there being first-class constraints, or in terms of there being the symmetry group being local, then reparameterizations come out as gauge symmetries, which is the reason why people treat them and people quantize them in that way. So the point is that type 2 symmetries and type 1, in what we're talking about is type 1 and type 2 gauge symmetries, i.e. local symmetries. But there are interesting connections between how you deal with global symmetries and how you deal with type 2 gauge symmetries. And so we actually talked about this at quite great length in an earlier paper. So there is a connection, definitely in terms of the conserved quantities associated with them. But the distinction is supposed to be purely between different types of gauge symmetries. But it's a very interesting question. The question really is, which distinctions between types of symmetries are best motivated physically? Really it's a question about symmetry and redundancy, right? So the point is that gauge symmetries are symmetries we normally associate with redundancy, which we have to remove from the phase space. Global symmetries aren't. And what we're saying is that reparameterization symmetries, although they're local symmetries and although they're associated with first-class constraints, shouldn't lead us to eliminate redundancy from the phase space, because at the level of the phase space description, there isn't redundancy. The redundancy is at the level of parameterizations of curves, not at the level of initial data. Whereas if you took the constraints in electromagnetism, they really are telling you that you need to remove degrees of freedom from the phase space. Okay, so the idea is that the observables, which we're calling Kukash observables, trace out curves labeled by arbitrary parameters, which is our time. And we're not treating that as observable. Rather, it's an independent parameter, as such can be specified independently of quantities which are deemed measurable within the theory. However, you can always use a parameter-free expression. So I won't go through the details. I'm sure many of you already know a lot about this already. So if we take partial observables to be the center of mass for our model, we define the partial observables in terms of the center of mass coordinates. And then the little q's will be the integrals of motion given by the little q's will give the flow equations. We can make a clock choice, invert one of these equations, and then reinsert it, and be able to produce the well-known expression for complete observables, which I think Bianca may have been the first to have derived, I'm not sure. So this for our model, this what we're the elimination of the parameter will lead to a complete observable in the standard way for any choice of, or it's actually a family of complete observables labeled by the value of the physical degree of freedom, which we're treating as the clock. So we can deparameterize we can use a complete and partial observables program to deparameterize the evolution purely in terms of observable quantities. However, we think that the evolution is still fundamentally controlled by 16, even though it has a parameter which is unmeasurable. This parameter still has physical significance. So if you want to, even if you want to use complete observables expressions, you're still required to retain the partial observables to have all the dynamical information of the system. And interestingly, this is actually quite closely related as so far as type 2 symmetry goes. So let me say this a bit more clearly. For type 2 symmetries, we think you're required to retain the full partial observable expressions. We don't think that's the case for type 1 symmetries. So for us, partial observables should always be associated with a measurable quantity. But when we're talking about type 2 symmetries, but not type 1. So to a limited extent, this actually supports Ravelli's perspective that partial observables should be measurable, which has been criticized in the literature. So I think I'm not doing so well for time, so I'll skip the summary and we can come back to any relevant details. So the obvious question is, what does this mean for quantization? And like, one of the main reasons of looking at the Hamilton-Jacobi formalism is it's quite easy to see what an interpretation of a Hamilton-Jacobi formalism classically, it's quite natural to see what that implications are for the quantum formalism. So, as I've been saying, standard canonical quantization procedures are founded upon a particular identification of the physical degrees of freedom that assumes you have to eliminate redundancy from the representation of physical states. So while such an identification is well justified for type 1 symmetries, it's not justified for type 2 symmetries. And we think the case of reparameterization invariance explicitly illustrates this point, since, as we've already discussed, such a symmetry can be understood in terms of redundancy at the level of histories, but doesn't mean any redundancy in the level of states or phase space. So if we label our type 2 symmetries beta, and the type 1 symmetries beta and the type 2 symmetries mu, we can put requirements on the relevant quantization that we're looking for. So the classical Kukash observable should be the basis for the algebra of quantum observables, defined as emission operators on the Hilbert space. We should define quantum wave functions as element of the physical Hilbert space and invariant under change with respect to type 1 parameters. But these wave functions should evolve according to the evolution equation that reduces in the semi-classical limit to the generalized Hamilton-Jacobi equation for the type 2 parameters. And this naturally leads us to expect that the wave function should exist in superpositions of eigenstates of the constant motion associated with the type 2 symmetries. And so our procedure for relational quantization is designed to satisfy these requirements. So we take the well-trodden road from Hamilton-Jacobi theory to quantum mechanics and take the characteristic function as the basis for a complex wave function defined in a Hilbert space labeled by eigenvalues of a complete set of the Kukash observables and the independent parameters. We take the usual symplectic structure to generalize to the operator algebra, and then the kind of third crucial equation, we take the functional dependence of the wave function on independent parameters to be given by this equation here. Now, for type 1 symmetries, we don't want to say anything new. So this is interpreted, this equation here is interpreted as a kinematical restriction on the theory. So physical states should be independent of the parameters at which label the orbits of type 1 symmetries, as per usual Dirac quantization. So the physical Hilbert space should be constructed in such a way that inner product is invariant under the constraints, under these particular type 1 constraints. And this coincides with the usual Dirac analysis, and we can draw on a huge amount of work of doing this rigorously, such as using techniques like group averaging. But, and here's what we want to say that's new, for type 2 symmetries, this equation here, 20, should be interpreted as there should be no more further kinematical restrictions on the wave functions. And rather, this equation gives change physical change in the states. So the operators, which are self-adjoint operators on the Hilbert space, physical Hilbert space, should commute with the type 1 constraints, but not with the type 2 constraints. And so this is the notion of a Kukash observable. And because of that, we're going to get a generalized Heisenberg equation of this form. So essentially, what we're advocating is to treat the quantum version of reparameterization invariant theories like you would treat non-relativistic quantum mechanics in general. So we should have a Heisenberg equation, and we should have a non-trivial action of the Hamiltonian operator on observables. And so there's quite a clear distinction between what we're advocating and applying the Dirac quantization procedure in full. So we have a larger set of observables because we don't have this requirement of commuting with the type 2 constraints. And this means that we're going to have a different quantum state, and specifically we're going to have superpositions of eigenstates of the operator related to the type 2 generating symmetries. So what this means is we have different physical predictions. So while in the classical theory, the extension procedure didn't change the physics, in the quantum theory, it does. Relational quantization leads to different predictions for the behavior observables compared to Dirac quantization. And so what's the kind of immediate application of this to a model slightly more complicated than a simple reparameterization invariant particle model is to look at mini superspace. And so if we just take pretty much, I think, the simplest possible mini superspace model, there's actually no need to look at such a simple model. We could look at more complicated mini superspace models, where we have a flat FLRW with a free massless scalar field. Then the phase space of such model just has four parameters: the scalar field, the scale factor of the universe, and the canonical momenta. And the Hamiltonian constraint will just have this fairly simple form, which is very similar to the particle model we looked at earlier. And so if we take a particular factor ordering and take a substitution, we can rewrite the quantum version of this Hamiltonian in this form here. And what's obviously the important point is that since we're treating the reparameterization symmetry associated with Hamiltonian constraint as type 2, since we've taken a different interpretation, the quantization doesn't lead to a Wheeler-DeWitt type equation. It leads to a Schrodinger type equation. So the equation 20 I put up before with the general dependence upon the parameters for a type 2 generating constraint for this model just means that we have dependence upon the parameter which labels the orbits of the Hamiltonian constraint, which is just time. And what's suggestive is if we take a separation anastas, we go to a reduced equation of this form here. And what that really tells us is that particular solutions will be solutions of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation for this model, and will be independent of time. And there'll be eigenstates of the constant which we use in the separation anastas, which is just we can identify as the cosmological constant. However, the general solution will actually have superpositions of eigenstates and dependence upon the parameter. And what was interesting is that this model was derived by Unruh and Wald in 1989 based upon quite a different motivation coming from unimodular gravity. And so the kind of obvious question that's been in the background for the whole talk is really made clear, because one of the main problems in the unimodular approach was ambiguities regard to foliation invariants. And so it's quite natural to ask whether these kind of issues are also problematic for us. So that's what I want to talk about. How much time do I have? Okay, so as I'm sure you all know, canonical general relativity is a totally constrained theory, and there's two constraints. And really, a lot of what we've been saying can be summed up in the idea just that there is something fundamentally different about these two constraints, between the momentum constraints, which are clearly type 1, and the Hamiltonian constraints, which have a slightly more ambiguous status. So everything I've said is really based upon the assumption that when they exist, state symmetries can be unambiguously identified at the level of phase space. And this is the case for the spatial diffeomorphism symmetries. However, it's clearly not the case for the refoliation symmetry connected to the Hamiltonian constraint, since this isn't actually represented as in terms of a sequence of physically indistinguishable states in phase space. So if you refoliation symmetry really comes from. Sure.
Here there's a big difference from that law between the global kind of time reparameterization variance of the model we discussed, where it's true that there is a change in the history but no change in the state.
Yeah.
And this case with the foliation variance, what's the mixed that.
Exactly.
So there is a change in the state.
Exactly. Yeah. So the point is that here we have a symmetry that which operates fundamentally at the level of histories, but clearly has some impact at the level of states because it leads to an undetermination problem. But you still don't have a way of defining refoliations at a point in the ADM phase space. But they still have it. They clearly make a difference to the symmetries at a point. So you're right. Really, refoliations aren't like global reparameterizations, but they're also not like spatial diffeomorphisms. There's something in between.
If you didn't know about space time, how would you know? Because, I mean, I'm worried that you're making a circular argument. Otherwise, I would, to me, the argument would be clear if you gauge this, the recollation with average lab zero, and separate the cleanly from a global reparameterization trend.
Yeah. And I think what we really need is a formalism which allows us to do that. So I think that's the point, right? So like we've got a way of thinking about quantization which puts certain requirements on how the symmetries of the theory can be clearly separated. And as it is, refoliations can't be cleanly separated in a sense. So this is a lovely quote, I think, I can't remember who it's by, maybe by Halliwell, saying that in ADMGR, the symmetry and the dynamics are intrinsically entangled or something like that. They're all mixed together. And really what that means in our language is that there's the type 1 and type 2 symmetries can't be unambiguously separated. Sure. Yeah. So I think. So the. So the point is, we want to isolate the physical variables of the theory in such a way that we can consistently quantize them. And this.
But you make, I mean, it seems to me you always have to make first a choice, or will be predefined, you always define first what you understand as physical equivalent.
Yeah, and I think what we're really doing is. What we're really doing is. But I think the point is, what we're doing is motivating a different choice to what's made in standard approaches. Sean, do you want to say something?
I think that, you have more to say about
this.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll be able to address that.
Okay. I haven't got much time either. So let me finish. I think we'll probably come back to exactly this point at the end. So this might seem a problem, right? And what we really want to say is that actually, this is really a problem for any consistent approach to canonical quantization. That really you need a notion of indistinguishable classical states is required to motivate a canonical quantization, which is based upon the notion of quantum state. Without being able to identify which classical states are physically equivalent, the problem of constructing a Hilbert space of distinct quantum states isn't well posed. And so that such an identification is not possible within the standard ADM formalism, at least that's what we're saying, is actually a severe problem for the canonical quantization and motivates particular requirements for quantization. And so these are our, what we think are four reasonable requirements given the framework in which we've presented. So that we start with the ADM data and we take instantaneous physical, we assume the spatial diffeomorphisms as a type 1 symmetry, and we want to treat them as generating unphysical change. And all the other constraints we just require to be categorizable as type 1 or type 2. And then we want some consistency with the original formalism. And we also want the dynamical degrees of freedom to be dynamical. We want them to be propagated. And so, given the ADM variables and the ADM Hamiltonian, we do need to separate type 1 and type 2 symmetries. We need to find a gauge fixing. And this gauge fixing is going to have to be something which we can associate integral curves that foliate the space of instantaneous configuration data and gives us the notion of simultaneity so that we can actually know what indistinguishable hypersurfaces or data on hypersurfaces, we can define that notion so we can talk about quantum states which pick up only the physically relevant differences.
Here maybe I can address your point that you made earlier. When you said, okay, you want to choose a gauge fixing, and that's basically his point two. We need to define notion of simultaneous. That's what gauge fixing and Hamiltonian constraint is. But in addition, we're also requiring another ingredient, which you may or may not agree with, but that's that the that gauge fixing also give you a notion of how to identify instantaneous states which are physically equivalent. And another way of stating that is that you need something that generates an orbit on configuration space. So that's not necessarily. So that's the question.
And so, there's only a few more slides left. So the point is, to our knowledge, and what we're hoping to work with Enrique Gomez and showing a uniqueness result along the lines of some of his recent work, is we take the trace pi equals zero gauge fixing to satisfy requirements, possibly uniquely. And as I'm sure many of you suspected, this is exactly how to lead from the way we're thinking about quantization, which, remember, in principle, had nothing to do with shape dynamics. So we haven't got any type of uniqueness result at the moment, but the idea is to be able to show that under certain certain restrictions on possible constraints on the ADM phase space, this gauge fixing comes out as unique. Sean can talk about Enrique's stuff. Oh, Lee, in fact.
The gauge fixing condition should be themselves first class with each other within the coordinates. So that you have a dual situation where the first class nature and Hamiltonian constraint with itself and with the different coordinates is matched by the gauge fixing condition. So that they can be each equivalent seem to be the constraint that generates the gauge transformation.
So gauge fixing is itself invariant, the transformation is invariant in the default constraint.
And it's first pass with respect to itself too, because it's in another gauge fixing condition. Just like the Hamiltonian constraint has value that it closes on the fifth Morgan constraint, the gauge fixing condition itself should have an option. And then Enrique's lemma is that if you want a pair of first class extensions of the state of the coordinate constraint that gauge fix each other but by themselves each makes a first class system, then that unique choice is the Hamiltonian constraint on the one side and trace pi on the other side, with one additional condition, which is you can add trace pi also.
So the idea really is that these types of result, like you can appeal to these types of result to motivate shape dynamics, given kind of what you desire for your classical starting point for quantization. But we haven't actually this the connection between Enrico's work and our motivation for quantization isn't explicit at the moment. So I won't. There's not much I can say about that right now. But we'd hope to flesh that out in more detail soon. So let me conclude. So there were six things which I wanted to claim that you get out of why this stuff is interesting, why this is a fruitful approach. So we certainly have something new or different. In terms of how to think about observables and their evolution in totally constrained theories. And we have this quite flexible, quite powerful generalized Hamilton-Jacobi formalism, which quite naturally allows us to recover Dirac observables. And in particular, it gives us a slightly different way of thinking about complete and partial observables, and some support for Ravelli's intuition that partial observables should be treated as measurable. The quantum formalism gives us new physics, in some senses, old physics. It gives us the physics of time-dependent quantum mechanics. It gives us dynamical wave function superpositions of any energy eigenstates. But it also gives us extra observables. Because essentially, if you're doing a Dirac quantization and using the complete observables program, the observable you treat as a clock, you don't have a quantum operator associated with it. Whereas in our formalism, every partial observable, ignoring type 1 symmetries, all the partial observables should have operators related to them. And it also has this natural connection to Mini's superspace model of unruly walled, and we're quite interested in exploring the solution of this model, seeing if it gives any interesting behavior. And there's a natural connection between our prescription of canonical quantization and the shape dynamics formulas. Thank you.
Good time for questions. Systems where this approach will be helpful that are not GR itself?
So, certainly other than mini-superspace as well.
Yeah, so that's GR in a sector. I was thinking of
So any theory which you, which is reparameterization invariant, will have a Hamiltonian constraint.
For sure.
So any theory which is reparameterization invariant. Sure.
So it's really for GR, it would seem that you really need to think hard about those issues. So I'm curious whether somehow there's a feedback here and we can move forward.
So I'm quite interested, because obviously string theory has reparameterization invariant actions as well, so I'd be quite interested to see what the connection was. But other than theories which are reparameterization invariant and we don't have much choice in the matter, right, it's really general relativity, shape dynamics, which is in a sense the same as general relativity, and string theory the only ones I could think of. Which is quite interesting, right? Why don't people talk about problem of time in string theory? Yeah.
We don't have to choose the representation of the superposition more than the server has an option. We choose. Well, certainly is not moving. But we find that the anomalous three instructions, starting with the anomalous, the representation of the rare store algebra, which has the anomalous data, so the width group is not. Anyway, this is maybe a sign.
I think it would be interesting. And also, you obviously have two parameters. You have the string length and the actual time.
Yeah,
so it would be quite interesting. So you'd actually have to extend it twice, in a sense.
Yes, it seems to me that you're replacing the ambiguity of choosing the gauge using this ambiguity logical tap one tap two, because as far as I can tell, there's no formal definition which you put tap one tap two. It's in your model you choose it.
That's not completely true. There are formal ways, right? So for example, the Hamiltonian constraint has a Lagrange multiplier that is definite. Why do we choose it to be definite? I mean, that's a very specific. The lapse is to be definite. You
don't positive.
Or strictly positive. I mean, okay. You don't want it to go from zero, because then the space time picture breaks down.
But it's also, there's a formal difference, right? Like, the origin of the Hamiltonian constraint really comes just from this, from the identity, like from like differential calculus, not from redundancy. It was a different kind of formal origin. What's it called? The theorem that you homogeneous. It comes from the homogeneous function theorem, which is quite a different formal, like mathematically. You can understand why the constraint arises without really necessarily talking about redundancy. I think there is a reasonable mathematical ways to pick out this, the Hamiltonian constraint as being different. Sorry. Yeah.
And in this case, the one-to-one map could be solution of the Hilbert space and computation and the standard Hilbert. So everything can be met one-to-one, which tells me that okay, it seems to be very consistent.
If I have a one degree of freedom system in normal quantum mechanics, I can describe the evolution of that system. Whereas if I Dirac quantize that system, I can't deparameterize because I've got nothing to deparameterize
it
to.
You
add the param. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Sure. So I completely agree. No. So if you take parameterized particle mechanics and do a Dirac quantization, you'll end up with exactly the same equations as we're like. So for the, where is it? For mini superspace, you'll just end up with the same quantum formalism. So in that sense, what we're advocating is equivalent to extension plus Dirac quantization. But the question is really, doing that for general relativity is difficult because we don't know how to to completely parameterize the theory and keep the refoliation invariance. But for shape dynamics, the idea would be to have a parameterized version of shape dynamics, and then you could Dirac quantize that. So I don't think what we're saying isn't, in a sense, particularly revolutionary. We're saying that the if you have a reparameterization invariant classical system, you could either apply extend the phase space and Dirac quantize, or apply this Hamilton-Jacobi route, and that these would be essentially the same. Okay. So
original classical phase space. So if I was going to do this to mini superspace, what it would mean is that I don't deparameterize with respect to one of five.
Let's
not even. So to clarify, you speak of three spaces. I speak of the original classical system. then you can make it into a data modification inline system by adding a new field. You seem to kind of add another degree of field.
Oh. But mini superspace is already reparameterization invariant without any additional. Okay. Okay. Yeah, yeah. That's a good question. Okay. Yeah, okay, so I was confused with the question.
It's really key in our approach to say what are really identify the physical degrees of freedom, which is why, like,
we make some input that we need to
call. We need an input from physics, that's our claim. That we really like the way to think about quantizing the systems comes from the physical input, which is what are the physical degrees of freedom. I would like to think of it the other way, right? That it's the physics that tells us what we measure, and that we define an action principle which is reflected in that physics.
You know, if you have an action, you think of all the future response. And so the action you even can depend on the direction which will give you a response. So it's even if you have an action, it actually tells you what the action is.
But that's what we're kind of arguing, that it's not as always that straightforward, right? That, I mean, this is a really good discussion. I'm not trying to dismiss, but like the reason for making the distinction between the type 1 and type 2 is precisely because just by looking at the symmetries of the action, you don't know, that doesn't tell you what the degrees of freedom are, because in our view, degrees of freedom have to do with what you can identify at an instant. Sort of. So,
but what's exactly, I mean, the exact thing I think it's about that when it comes to the real generosity situation is that people start with the idea, we'll say in the spatial compact case, a slice through a history is originally identified, and another slice through the same history have exactly the same degrees of freedom at the same time. That is, they've convinced us that what looks like a time translation in the four-dimensional manifold perspective is actually just a realizing of the same physical degrees of freedom, which shows the same solution. And you're disagreeing with that.
Yeah.
You're just saying, if I disagree with that, I can quantize in such a way that I gauge fixed and maybe shorter quantization.
Yeah.
What's unclear to me is that was said in 1960 in response to ADM, and could have been said at any time since ADM. And you've added a long, convoluted logical argument to get you to the same place that somebody might have got to just by refusing the logic of the argument.
Well,
and let me just finish by
sure.
Question. And have you, given that there's an arbitrary choice of both, the phi is ambiguous, and what does it mean to be at the same time? Have you made an argument that would have convinced people on the other side? Or are you just offering another, deciding what kind of way you move to an argument that would have rejected the other perspective?
I think it's a very good question, but I think there's a lot to say, right? So I think there's a difference between the issues of the ADM formalism and ambiguity regarding refoliation invariance, and the extremely simple question about how we should treat the global mode of the Hamiltonian constraint. And how we should quantize that.
Global reparamentization variance or reparamentation variance on a single particle. Your point is crystal clear because
yeah, yeah.
The definition
sure.
of transformations that don't change the instantaneous state is ambiguous. But unfortunately, it is ambiguous
yeah, yeah.
in general relativity. I haven't tried to be sympathetic with your conclusion, but I was already trying to be sympathetic
sure.
with your conclusion. I'm not sure that you're going to convince somebody. Say Julian Barbara, not the current Julian Barbara, but Julian
yeah.
20 years ago, of the end of time Julian.
Yeah.
I'm not sure you would have convinced the end of time Julian.
Well, I think we were actually struggling to convince the now Julian, so in a sense. So really the question is, what the whole thing could be restructured as a negative argument against Wheeler-DeWitt quantization of ADMGR, right? Then it wouldn't be a particularly exciting story. It would just be saying that there is something missing in this formalism in terms of how we're treating the Hamiltonian constraint in quantum gravity. The fact that the dynamic, like, that there is change.
But there's a whole story
yeah.
about perennial.
So I think the point is that, so I think one of the points is really that if you agree with Ravelli regarding the partial observables being measurable, you should worry more about whether those measurable quantities are being represented in the quantum formula.
Carlo didn't say that partial observables are certainly measurable. He said partial observables for components of true observables.
So there's some change in his position.
Did you say that?
Yeah.
He says actually like partial observers are measurable and complete observers are predictable.
Yeah.
So I always didn't agree with this part of the paper.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
to me, every measurement you do is implicitly a complete observer. So it's
okay, I'm always measurable.
But in a sense,
one thing is never as legitimate.
I think so.
I told him. He never listened to me.
You can apply complete observers also with saying the partial observers.
Anyway, we all agree there was a story about full observable time emerge. Build the clock in the system and time will emerge. There really is change. Perennial ability to measure change when one of the diseases appears inside of perennials, discuss the correlation of a clock variable with other variables. We all knew the story. You disagree with the story, and that's fine. I think there's grounds to disagree with the story. But one of them is not a logical inconsistency of the story. I don't think.
The only thing I heard, which, for me, made me think in their favor, is what you told me, that it's true that, in the constraints, I mean, you don't have a general definition of type 1 and type 2 separations. You know, in certain models, it's true that the Laplace multiplier, so at the classical level, it doesn't make any difference, but at the quantum level, we treat the Laplace multiplier of the Hamiltonian constraint as being positive. And that leads to the fact that in the particle case, we have, we have virtual particles, which is functional. That's kind of that's kind of a mystery. In some sense, this is, why do we have to do finite quantization? I don't know. that's related. It's impossible to see at the classical level. It's still a mystery to me, the quantum behavior. And I guess if that's what you're saying, then I agree. There is a distinction.
So one thing,
but I